It is entirely possible that Thomas Jefferson had never met Alexander Hamilton before the day Jefferson arrived in New York City to take up his task as Secretary of State. But it took him no time at all to conclude that Hamilton was the consummation of every political evil in Jefferson's dictionary. Hamilton was indeed a singular character, Jefferson would write years later, a compromise between the two systems of royalism and republicanism. Washington had hoped that Hamilton and myself would coalesce in the measures of the government. But Jefferson frankly told Washington, "My wish was to see both houses of Congress cleansed of all persons interested in the bank or public stocks, and especially cleansed of a corrupt squadron of voters in Congress at the command of the Treasury." Hamilton's principles, he told Washington at some length, were adverse to liberty, and were calculated to undermine and demolish the Republic by creating an influence of his department over the members of the legislature. I saw this influence actually produced by the votes of the very persons who, having swallowed his bait, were laying themselves out to profit by his plans. These were no longer the votes then of the representatives of the people, but of deserters from the rights and interests of the people. Of course, Jefferson had been operating under an influence of his own. I had left France in the first year of the Revolution in the fervor of natural rights and zeal for reformation. And while he was already disposed to greet the uprisings in France in 1789 favorably, that favor had been aroused and excited by daily exercise. And what an exercise! When Louis XVI became King of France in 1774, 3 months short of his 20th birthday, his sole qualification for exercising that exalted and absolute power was his birth. He was utterly unequipped by temperament, training, or simple intellect to comprehend the seriousness of the problems he had inherited. France was on the edge of bankruptcy. Not merely temporary financial bad times, but a deep-bottomed bankruptcy which had been brewing throughout a century of reckless military and imperial adventures, including the alliance with the Americans and the American Revolution. All of this had yielded France next to nothing in real profit. That, combined with population pressure, agricultural failures, the mismanagement of the treasury, the long-term wastage of French imperial opportunities, the truculence of the nobility. All of these failures came together in one shattering crescendo of crisis in 1789. In desperation, the king had called together a national convention, the Etats Généraux, in the spring of 1789, to force reforms down the throat of an unwilling aristocracy. The Etats Généraux swiftly bolted ahead to declare itself a national assembly with full governing powers for the nation. But the assembly's deliberations were themselves overtaken by bread riots in the streets of Paris in June and July, which climaxed on July 14th when the rioters stormed and captured the royal armory in Paris's old Bastille. 3 days after the Bastille fell, Louis XVI paled before the hungry Parisian masses and the National Assembly and drove into Paris to put on the new national colors of the Assembly, a cockade of red and blue for the city of Paris, ringing the traditional white of the French monarchy. 10 days later, the Assembly began debate on a new constitution for France, beginning with a Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, which distilled into 17 pungent articles the whole of the Enlightenment's notions of human society. In the 4 months between May and July 1789, France was transformed from an absolute monarchy into a constitutional monarchy, with Louis XVI still as the figurehead ruler, but with real political power now belonging to the National Assembly. Until 1784, when he was posted to Paris as the chief American diplomatic representative, Jefferson's Enlightenment had been a conventionally English one, dominated above all by John Locke. And Jefferson's first impressions of America's principal ally in the Revolution were not positive ones. The nation, he confided to Abigail Adams in 1787, is incapable of any serious effort but under the word of command. The stars of the French Enlightenment, Voltaire, Diderot, d'Holbach, were frivolous and useful only for manufacturing puns and bon mots, and I pronounce that a good punster would disarm the whole nation were they ever so seriously disposed to revolt. The events of the spring of 1789 soon changed all of that before Jefferson's very eyes. The National Assembly, he excitedly wrote to Tom Paine, having shown through every stage of these transactions a coolness, wisdom, and resolution to set fire to the four corners of the kingdom and to perish with it themselves rather than to relinquish an iota from their plan of a total change of government, had excited Jefferson's imagination as nothing before. Even when the Paris mob seized the Bastille and beheaded the hapless officers of the Bastille, Jefferson shrugged it aside as a mere incident, since the decapitations had accelerated the king's surrender. As Jefferson would write later, in the struggle, which was necessary, many guilty persons fell without the forms of trial, and with them some innocent. But rather than seeing the French Revolution fail, I would have seen half the earth desolated. Were there but an Adam and an Eve left in every country and left free, it would be better than it is now. Jefferson's admiration for the French Revolution seemed to increase in direct proportion to his distance from it. And once he returned to America at the end of 1789, one of his chief motives for taking the post of Secretary of State was to observe and encourage the French eruption. When the National Assembly seized and redistributed the lands of the Catholic Church, when the king foolishly attempted to flee France, only to be captured, placed on trial, and executed, and when a committee of public safety began a national purge, the Reign of Terror, Jefferson continued to describe the French Revolution as part of the holy cause of freedom, and sniffed that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure. No surprise, then, that Jefferson was beside himself with fury when, on December 5, 1791, Hamilton submitted the third of his major reports to Congress as Secretary of the Treasury, a report on the subject of manufactures. The most obvious question which the creation of a Bank of the United States had posed was, in whose interest is a national bank going to operate? Hamilton's answer to that question was the report on manufactures. The expediency of encouraging manufactures in the United States, Hamilton asserted, which was not long since deemed very questionable, appears at this time to be pretty generally admitted. The United States could not forever remain an agricultural nation, Hamilton argued, depending on exporting its agricultural surpluses to Europe and using the proceeds to purchase manufactured goods from abroad. Britain's unwillingness to open its ports, especially in the West Indies, to American trade, was proof of the folly of that. To attain real independence, the United States needed to develop its own manufacturing base and let its agricultural profits stay at home to buy American manufactured goods. Manufacturing would promote foreign immigration, stimulate a spirit of enterprise, and above all, render the United States least dependent on the combinations, right or wrong, of foreign policy. And how did Hamilton propose to encourage manufacturing? Simple. The funded debt. The Bank of the United States would become the chief guarantor of investments in manufacturing. Hamilton fully anticipated that this plan would generate a question concerning the constitutional right of the government of the United States to apply this species of encouragement, but Hamilton waved this away as easily as he had waved away a similar objection to the bank on the basis of the Necessary and Proper Clause. Only this time he cited the Constitution's authority for encouraging manufacturing from the preamble to provide for the common defense and general welfare. These proposals maddened Jefferson, who had raised no stop sign to the progress of the first two of Hamilton's reports. But now they raised the hackles not only of Jefferson, but of every agrarian, like John Randolph of Roanoke, who believed that American farm interests were now going to be fleeced for the benefit of manufacturing. Agriculture made every farmer an independent owner of his own production, according to Jefferson's view. Manufacturing reduced workers to mere employees, living on wages, while their employers, the owners, tricked unsuspecting farmers into borrowing to buy goods they didn't need. Worse still, manufacturing would require startup capital, which Hamilton was already starting to acquire. And that would require banks, which Hamilton had already designed. And both of these would create a class of financiers who dealt in invisible and presumably fraudulent wealth on paper and in ledger books. The end result would be the multiplication of speculators, monarchists, aristocrats, and Tories. The agriculturalist has his property, his land, his all, complained John Randolph of Roanoke, while the commercial speculators live in opulence, whirling in coaches and indulging in palaces. Alert, vigilant, enterprising, and active, the manufacturing interests are collected in masses and ready to associate at a moment's warning for many purposes of general interest to their body. Do but ring the fire bell, and you can assemble all the manufacturing interests of Philadelphia in 15 minutes. Nay, for matter of that, they are always assembled, and compare notes, and lay plans, and possess in trick and intelligence what in the goodness of God to them the others can never possess. In the face of such evil, Jefferson saw no corrective, as he put it in a letter to the equally disgruntled George Mason, except in the augmentation of the numbers in the lower house so as to get a more agricultural representation, which may put that interest above that of the stock jobbers. The idea that a republic could be composed of interests was as far removed from each other in principle as agricultural and manufacturing. That was a distinction which was fearful in the minds of many of the makers of the new government. Not that varieties of special interests didn't exist. It was that, according to the classical model of virtuous republicanism, they shouldn't exist. Or if they did, they should be deplored, because interests promoted conflict rather than consensus. Madison, in Federalist No. 51, has suggested that although interests would exist in the United States, the sheer number of them would cancel out each other's influence and prevent any one interest from gaining the upper hand. But notice, he was by no means applauding the existence of conflicting interests as a good, but rather as a manageable evil. In a monarchy, of course, interests ran wild. The interests of the court, for pomp, luxury, and power over others, ran against the interests of the country for simplicity, thrift, and religion. And the collision of those interests produced corruption, instability, and political factions. Or, to use the more popular term, parties. At best, parties were mere engines of patronage. At worst, they were conspiracies against the common good. Jefferson had been so averse to the notion of parties in politics that in March of 1789, he had written Francis Hopkinson from Paris to denounce political parties. "I have never submitted the whole of my system of opinions to the creed of any party of men whatever, in religion, in philosophy, in politics, or in anything else where I was capable of thinking for myself. Such an addiction is the last degradation of a free and moral agent. If I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go there at all." But that was then. This was now. And now required Jefferson to begin the formation of the first American political party to resist Hamilton's innovations in debt, banking, and manufacturing through three distinctive actions. First, Jefferson began assembling allies, and in some cases, smoothing over previous differences between people he thought he could count upon. George Mason had fought Madison tooth and nail at the Constitutional Convention, but Jefferson wanted both of them beside him, and so he acted as a broker of a rapprochement between Mason and our friend, Mr. Madison. Despite some late difference, Mason conceded, "Madison is one of the few men I really esteem." Mason now decided that "I have more liberality than to think the worse of a friend for a disagreement on any theoretical opinions." And Jefferson cheerfully passed a word of reconciliation back to Mason. "I have always heard Madison say that though you and he appeared to differ in your systems, yet you were, in truth, nearer together than most persons. You may quiet yourself in the assurance of possessing his complete esteem." Second, Jefferson began appealing to carefully selected individuals to run for Congress. Learning of Colonel Henry Innes's disapprobation of the debt assumption, Jefferson urged Innes to try for a seat in the next Congress, to establish principles and examples which may fence us against future heresies preached now to be practiced hereafter. "Jefferson was confident in the purity of your republicanism, and such zeal and talents added to the republican scale would do no harm." In the summer of 1791, Jefferson and Madison began a month-long tour of New York and the Hudson Valley, ostensibly to fish and gather zoological specimens, but partly to establish contacts with Governor George Clinton, New York's arch anti-federalist. Third, Jefferson surreptitiously began playing for control of the media, or at least for a beachhead among the newspapers. 3 days after Washington signed the enabling bill for the Bank of the United States, Jefferson hired Philip Morin Freneau as a translator at the Department of State. Despite his French-sounding name, Freneau was actually a New Yorker. His parents were Huguenot refugees from France. He had attended Princeton alongside Madison and suffered a spell in a British prison hulk during the Revolution. Freneau might well have been a decent translator of French, but he had made his career since the war as a journalist with the virulently anti-Hamilton New York Daily Advertiser. Jefferson and Madison wanted him as their journalistic mouthpiece. The translator's job would give Freneau cover and an income. And in October of 1791, Freneau began publishing the National Gazette to defeat the doctrines of monarchy aristocracy, and the exclusion of the influence of the people from Congress. Meanwhile, Jefferson also sought to woo Benjamin Franklin Bache, the grandson of Benjamin Franklin and the publisher of the General Advertiser, which Bache soon renamed the Aurora and a General Advertiser, the principles of which, according to Jefferson, were always Republican. 3 weeks after Freneau's National Gazette began publishing, Madison appeared in its columns with a series of articles which claimed, in good Jeffersonian fashion, that agriculturalists, who provide at once their own food and their own raiment, may be viewed as the most truly independent and happy. They are more. They are the best basis of public liberty and the strongest bulwark of public safety. It follows that the greater the proportion of this class to the whole society, the more free, the more independent, and the more happy must be the society itself. If this fostered the creation of political parties, so what? Parties, Madison decided, were unavoidable in a republic. In some sense, they might even represent a kind of self-protective agency, since at present American politics was already being driven into factions by Hamilton. One faction well affected to the Union and good government, and the other having debauched themselves into a persuasion that mankind are incapable of governing themselves, has become the party of monarchy and aristocracy, and can conceive that government can be carried on only by the pageantry of rank, the influence of money and emoluments, and the terror of military force. Just how much political heavy weather Jefferson could generate by these tactics soon became apparent when Congress took up Hamilton's report on manufactures in February 1792. Hamilton began off balance. His longtime business partner, William Duer, had embarrassed him in December by setting up charters for three new private banks in New York City, the Million Bank, the Merchants Bank, and the Tammany Bank, all to be capitalized at over $1 million apiece, and looking for all the world like what Hamilton was proposing to do with the Bank of the United States. As if to confirm everything Jefferson had been warning about, this speculation collapsed in March 1792, sending prices of shares in the banks plummeting. Duer's partners fled the city, and Duer himself spent the next 7 years in debtor's prison. Hamilton was even more seriously compromised by a blackmail scandal involving an affair with a flirtatious 23-year-old widow, Maria Reynolds, who turned out not to be a widow at all. When her husband, James Reynolds, reappeared, he tried to screw money out of Hamilton and at length offered to hostile congressmen to make disclosures injurious to the character of some head of a department. Filled with a mix of rancor and confidence, the Jeffersonians rose in the House of Representatives on March 8, 1792, to blame the New York City bank failures on Hamilton and to demand Hamilton's resignation from the Treasury. He was saved by a vote of 31-27, with Fisher Ames leading his defense. Later in March, the Jeffersonians demanded an investigation into military procurements. Again, Hamilton was exonerated. Finally, in September, Jefferson launched his ultimate missile at Hamilton, a letter to George Washington listing Hamilton's crimes against the Republic. "The internal dissensions which have taken place within our government," Jefferson informed the president, "have had a disagreeable effect on its movements. Jefferson had always planned," he wrote, "as Secretary of State, to intermeddle not at all with the legislature and as little as possible with my co-departments. But Hamilton had duped him. in the reports on public credit and the National Bank, and made him a tool for forwarding his schemes. And Jefferson now wanted satisfaction. Hamilton's system flowed from principles adverse to liberty and was calculated to undermine and demolish the Republic by creating an influence of his department over the members of the legislature. Especially, the report on the subject of manufactures is a scheme to draw all the powers of government into the hands of the general legislature, to establish means for corrupting a sufficient core in that legislature to divide the honest votes and preponderate by their own the scale which suited, and to have that core under the command of the Secretary of the Treasury for the purpose of subverting step by step the principles of the Constitution, which he has so often declared to be a thing of nothing which must be changed. It was as close as being an ultimatum as it could be, without actually saying, him or me. But Washington was having none of it. He had been deeply wounded by the partisan turn of the newspapers, stuffing their papers with scurrility and nonsensical declamation. And he was incensed at the publications in Freneau's and Bache's papers as outrages on common decency. He had known, he told Jefferson, that there was a marked difference in our political sentiments, but he had never suspected it would go so far in producing a personal difference. And he wished he could be the mediator to put an end to it. Now he turned the tables on Jefferson by threatening not to stand for a second presidential term that fall if the bickering went on. That was the trump card. Even Jefferson acknowledged that Washington was the only man in the United States who possessed the confidence of the whole. And in the fall of 1792, the state electors once again handed Washington a unanimous ballot as president and gave John Adams a resounding endorsement for vice president. But the challenge of parties, and especially Jefferson's party, was not going to go away either. Jefferson was convinced that the congressional elections in 1792 have produced a decided majority in favor of the Republican interest. Since the 1790 census had created four new seats in the House, and Jeffersonians had won three of them, he was technically right, but Hamilton's friends still held a 10-seat majority. Hamilton's report on manufacturers was never fully adopted. And what was more, Washington and Hamilton were soon to hear another challenge, this time in the echoes of Daniel Shays.